You are listening to another Voice of Freedom broadcast, financed through the free will donations of listeners like yourself. I'm Ernst Sundl, your host and moderator. The opinions expressed by our guests or in editorials and stories are always those of the originators. We believe that personal opinions freely expressed are not a danger to any democratic society. We don't have to agree with any or all of the opinions expressed by others. We owe it to ourselves, however, to listen, to evaluate, and to possibly learn something new or different in the process. You may reach us at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1, telephone 1-416-922-9850. And now we have another interesting program for you. I'm Ernst Sundl with another Voice of Freedom program. You can reach us at 206 Carlton Street in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Our postal code is M5A2L1. Our telephone number is 416-922-9850. I have been reading and reading and reading this summer, and reading some very interesting books. And one of the books that I have reread is The Transfer Agreement. That sounds like an innocuous enough title. It seems innocent. What on heck is The Transfer Agreement? Well, The Transfer Agreement is a very, very important and informative book. It is written by Edwin Black and none other than Dr. Sybil Milton of the Simon Wiesenthal Center called it, quote, a spellbinding, exciting book. This subject has not been previously explored. It adds a significant new dimension to our understanding of this critical era. The cover is green, the lettering is golden, the subtitle is the initial title, The Transfer Agreement, and the subtitle, The Untold Story of the Secret Pact Between the Third Reich and Jewish Palestine. It was published in the United States, Macmillan Publishing Company in New York, Collier Macmillan Publishers of London. And I don't think you can get any more prestigious than this particular publishing house. And the book was dedicated to the 6 million, to my parents who survived, to my grandparents who did not. Copyright 1984 by Feature Group Incorporated. And as I said, it's the Macmillan Publishing Company, the title of the book, The Transfer Agreement. I bought the book for my trial in 1984. And gleaned from it some very important material, because this book by Edwin Black confirmed a film and a documentary I had made with an aged and aging Jewish advisor of mine. And Joseph Ginsburg, the son of a famous East European rabbi, I had befriended him, he had befriended me, and we had been corresponding with one another. I had visited him when I went to Europe, and finally, even though well into his 80s, he came to Toronto and made a film with me. And so, here I had an American-produced book by a prestigious American publisher confirming what Joseph Ginsburg, my Jewish friend, and my mentor had actually told me about, quote, Nazi-Zionist relations. Let me read to you part of the inside of the dust jacket on this book, because it basically sets the tone. As you know, I quoted you already, the Dr. Sybil Milton from the Simon Wiesenthal Center saying it is a spellbinding, exciting book. This subject has not been previously explored. It adds a significant new dimension to our understanding of this critical era, end of quote. So you see, these revisionist Voice of Freedom programs are very important, and they certainly are lauded if even the Simon Wiesenthal Center agrees that this book covers a subject which was not previously well illuminated. And Morris Frommer, an author of the American Jewish Congress, A History from 1914 to 1950, had this to say about the book: "Truly a brilliant piece of work. It has captured the passion, veracity, exaltation, and yes, naivete of that moment in history, an artistic tour de force." End of quote. The Dust Jacket then goes on and says, "The transfer agreement is the stunning, compassionate account of, quote, the deal with the devil," end of quote, "that saved 60,000 Jews from the Holocaust. The deal was made in desperation in 1933 between the Jewish leadership in Palestine and the Third Reich. The terms? That the Jewish-led boycott of German goods would ease in return for the transfer of German Jews to the Holy Land. Eventually, 1/10 of Germany's Jews were saved, thus helping to form the seedbed of modern Israel." Remember what I said to you in previous broadcasts and in my books and newsletters? Adolf Hitler sometimes is referred to as the founder of Israel. Here is Edwin Black, a Jew from Chicago, who wrote this truly brilliant piece of work, as Morris Frommer called it, saying exactly the same thing. And he also owes up to the fact that it was a Jewish-led boycott of German goods in the United States. Most people, most intellectuals, especially Jewish writers that I have ever debated on radio talk lines and have ever heard on radio programs and TV interviews, always denied that it was a Jewish-led boycott. There was a Jewish-led boycott, and Edwin Black flatly and honestly states it. The Dust cover goes on and says, "Edwin Black reveals for the first time the inside details of the controversial pact and recreates the drama, the personalities, the cliffhanger negotiations, and the anguish of world Jewry over their choice. And Black does more. He provides a true understanding of Israel's founding and the heartbreaking realities of the Jews' plight in Hitler's Europe. The transfer agreement presents certain truths that have long eluded historians. The financial nexus that served Hitler's obsession with expelling the Jews as an essential prelude to conquering Europe, together with the Zionists' resolve to bring their dispossessed people to Palestine. The American Jewish involvement is of special interest, as the author reconstructs the magnitude of the pro- and anti-boycott meetings and the passion invested in them." Now, it continues in the back flap of the book. "The author spent 5 years on 3 continents researching and writing this book. He was aided by a team of translators and researchers who unearthed previously suppressed, I wonder why, and widely dispersed documents and archives. Already acclaimed by a dozen diverse experts and Holocaust scholars, the transfer agreement was described by Dr. Sybil Milton of the Simon Wiesenthal Center as a spellbinding, exciting book," end of quote. Edwin Black has given us a work of history that will make history. Then it shows a picture of a handsome-looking young Jew, and it says, "Edwin Black is the son of Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. He was a founder of Chicago Monthly and frequently contributes to the Chicago Tribune and other publications. He lectures and writes extensively on Jewish and Israeli subjects." And just because some people will accuse me of anti-Semitism and all this kind of stuff, I'll read you the back cover. Quote, "Important new ground in our understanding of American Jewry's role in the rescue efforts of Jews in Germany and Eastern Europe, in Zionist aims and methods in creating the State of Israel, and in Nazi thinking on the road to the final solution. Black's research efforts extend far beyond the capabilities of one or even 2 authors. These things have been hinted at before, now they have been exposed." The person saying that is Abraham Peck, American Jewish Archives. And here is an endorsement from the Yad Vashem. "Edwin Black's research is striking in its dimension and scope. The vast uncovering of source material and its extensive use are almost overwhelming. He penetrates deep into the political and economic process of inter-Jewish relations and into Gentile attitudes involving the rescue of Jews from Nazi rule for the benefit of the Zionist enterprise in Eretz Israel. Who said that? Yoav Gelber, Yad Vashem, Israel Holocaust Memorial. And a final person is Arthur Schweitzer, author of Big Business and the Third Reich, and he says, excellent and revealing, fills the vacuum in the history of both the German economy and the Zionist movement. The book is informative, exciting, as well as challenging, and morally disturbing. End of quote. So now let's see here what Edwin Black actually said and why some people are so upset. Because I have in my archives an interview, a videotaped interview with Edwin Black and his parents, where both Edwin Black and his parents describe how they had to run the gauntlet in the Jewish community in America and especially in Chicago after this book came out, which is very, very similar to another courageous Jew by the name of John Sack, who recently published this extraordinary, eye-opening book on Jewish war crimes and mistreatment of Germans at the end of the Second World War, called An Eye for an Eye. Now, John Sack revealed on the television program 60 Minutes how his editors wouldn't talk to him, his friends shunned him, that he was even threatened to be killed if he published that book. And to his credit, even though the book is replete with references to laughable books that promote the Holocaust version of history, nevertheless, he had the courage to expose Jewish misdeeds against Germans. And here we have Edwin Black, this young Jewish fellow from Chicago, tackling this very thorny topic. He says, in the foreword, to prepare for a Chicago Reader interview with a Jewish ACLU attorney representing the neo-Nazis, I spoke with Jewish scholar Rabbi Byron Shervin. He told me there were many enigmas about the Jewish response to Nazism, one of which was a long-rumored arrangement between the Third Reich and the Zionist organization involving the assets of German Jews. He added that little was known about the arrangement, if it indeed existed. I couldn't believe what I had heard. The possibility of a Nazi-Zionist arrangement for the sake of Israel was inconceivable for a person of my background. My mother as a girl had been pushed by her mother through the vent of a boxcar on the way to Treblinka death camp. She was shot by Nazi soldiers and buried in a shallow mass grave. My father had stepped out of line during a long march to a death camp train. While hiding in the woods, he came upon a leg protruding from the snow. This was my mother. Together, by night and by courage, these two Polish teenagers survived in the forest for 2 years. When the war was over, they cautiously emerged from the woods, believing that all Jews had been exterminated except them. The question for them was whether there was still any use being Jewish. And yet, believing themselves to be the last of their people, they decided to live on as Jews and never forget. Wow. Now, there is a good Holocaust book for you. Do you know what I mean? I tell you why I read this. Because here is a young Jew knowing that the roof is going to cave in on him by what he is about to present. And so he kind of cloaks himself in the ultimate victimhood here, you know? I mean, if you can believe this story, you'll believe anything. But nevertheless, so often you will see writers, John Sack included, the man with this courage, they will rationalize to the nth degree, to the point when it becomes embarrassing. The Germans call this a kind of knee-jerking before you go and say something unpleasant, which is what I have noted also when academics discuss the Jewish, any Jewish issue, they always say the Jewish people or Jewish people. They never dare to say this Jew. And I have found how allergic Jews really are to be called Jews. Jeez, people have called me a German many times. I don't get allergic to it. I can't help if they're crooked Germans or evil Germans or monstrous Germans or nasty Germans. Heck, I've been a German for 55 years of my life. I have met my share of German creeps. Why shrink and not allow your own ethnic group to be criticized? If you are a Jew, allow yourself to be called a Jew. If you are a German, go ahead, call me a German. As long as you spell my name right. Now, so here is this young Edwin Black. And in the foreword, he says, "Yet there were incongruities I could never understand. Everywhere I looked in Israel, I saw German equipment. The names of Nazi commerce, Mercedes, Grundig, Siemens, Krupp, were thriving in the Jewish state, even as the ban on Wagner's music was strictly enforced. And so many families were German Jews who had come to Israel during the Hitler era." You see, here is this young Jew touring Israel, and what does he come across? German equipment, German commerce, Mercedes, Grundig, Siemens, Krupp. He comes across lots of German families who came to Israel during Hitler's reign. No wonder this guy was kind of stunned by this. And so he says, "For a year I filed Rabbi Shervin's rumor in a Mendel box of imponderables. He had said many times that the most important rule in approaching the Holocaust is that nothing makes sense." I repeat that. "That nothing makes sense with the Holocaust," this rabbi said. "And yet, I wanted to make sense out of it. If I did, then perhaps there was a reason my mother and father had lived while 6 million had died. Working through the staff and resources of Spertus College of Judaica, I was able to obtain some rare Hebrew and German materials that documented the skeletal form that the arrangement indeed existed." This is the arrangement for the transfer agreement he's talking about. "After a great deal of personal anguish, I made my decision," in other words, to write this book that we are quoting from. "When I told my parents, my mother threatened to disown me, and my father threatened personally to strangle me if I would dare lend any credence to the notion of Nazi-Zionist cooperation. This was done against the background of anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli attempts somehow to link the Nazi regime with Zionists, exemplified by the anti-Israeli statements of Vanessa Redgrave." You see what I mean? He knew, before he even got into this topic, that there was going to be hell to be paid, and both his parents knew it. And so they tried to scare him and try to say to him, "Don't do it or we disown you." But later on, as I say, I've got this video documentation where they are sticking by their son because they realized that what he had unearthed was historically very important. So, he goes on down the page, Roman numerals 12. "A Nuremberg trial expert declared he had never heard of a senior Reich bureaucrat involved in transfer negotiations. I spent 6 months gathering data to rebut the misinformation." So get that, eh? A Nuremberg trial expert said to this young Jewish writer that he had never found a senior German Reich bureaucrat that had helped negotiate this deal between the Germans and Zionist Palestine, and it was a blatant, outright lie which this young Jew had to spend 6 months trying to refute. What the hell does that tell you about the importance of this particular topic? A great deal. Then he continues on by saying, on page 13, "I found that little had been written about Hitler's first year." And he said, "Principal players who said one thing in public and did the opposite in private. Everything was upside down, and historians of the period told me they were equally confused about what really had occurred in that first year when Hitler was in power." Amazing, huh? "Hitler was not unique," he said. "He was organized. Among Hitler's enemies, none were organized except the Zionists. The world recognized the Hitler threat and hoped they would not arrive. The Zionists recognized the Hitler threat and always expected it. The event of the Hitler era and the transfer agreement were ultimately determined by two factors: my belief in the Jewish people in American Jewish organizations, in Zionism, and in the State of Israel, and its founding mothers and fathers is unshaken. Those who sense outrage or anger in my words are hearing, but the echo of agony. That's the end of his foreword. So, having prepared the ground, he then gives acknowledgments of 2.25 pages, where he mentions everything and everyone in Jewish circles, and also the German government, Yad Vashem, Shmuel Krakowski, the Yad Vashem Archives in Jerusalem, Central Zionist Archives in Jerusalem, American Historical Society in Waltham. Everybody who is anything in this topic is mentioned here. So this is not a fluff book. And then he goes to the meat of the subject, the ideological struggle. And he says that across the Atlantic, the German Reich took notice of Rabbi Weiss's visit to Washington. Goebbels and other party leaders were convinced that Rabbi Weiss was the archetypical power-broking Jew who could manipulate the United States Congress, the State Department, and even the President. Even as Weiss was finishing his round of Washington meetings, the Reich Foreign Office in Berlin dispatched a cable to its consulate in New York denying, quote, exaggerated press reports, end of quote, about, quote, brutal mistreatments. The cable denounced opponents of the present national government who are hoping that, well, quote, organized atrocity propaganda may undermine the reputation and authority of the national government, end of quote. And the statement added Hitler's personal assurance that future violence would be averted by tough new police efforts. So, this was on page 17. We turn to page 23, where he quotes or summarizes Adolf Hitler. Hitler attributed the stories about Germany's wartime atrocities to an international Jewish conspiracy using newspapers Jews secretly controlled, and so the Nazis held a special fear of what they called Greuel propaganda, or atrocity tales. In Nazi thought, it was Greuel propaganda, Nazi, you know, atrocity tales, that distorted German valor into Hun-like savagery. Greuel propaganda was a mighty weapon the Jews knew how to use to harness the German nation into bondage. Now, I want to quickly tell you, this is Edwin Black writing in his book, The Transfer Agreement, in the chapter called The Weapon Hitler Feared, on page 23. And then he tackles the economic situation in Germany. The lasting economic agonies of Versailles were soon apparent. Inflation wracked post-war Germany as the Weimar Republic struggled to keep pace with Allied reparation demands and domestic recovery. German currency was printed so fast that it was inked on one side only. In 1919, the value of the mark was around 9 marks to $1. In 1921, it was 75 marks to $1. In 1922, 400 to $1. And in early January 1923, 7,000 marks equaled $1. So this is what the economic kind of background is to what is about to happen. On page 30, Edwin Black, in the chapter The Weapon Hitler Feared, says, Jews also believed in the power of Jewish boycotts. It mattered little whether the real might of the boycott was the statistical business harm or simply the perception of it. Boycott was a weapon the Jews were ready and willing to use in emergencies to dissuade the forces of anti-Semitism. The anti-Henry Ford boycott was but a commercial skirmish compared to the international financial war waged against Russian Tsar Nicholas II by Jewish banker Jacob Schiff and the American Jewish Committee. The war began when Jews were blamed for Russia's social and economic chaos in the 1880s. Now you see, this is the first time that I hear an admission like that. On page 32, Edwin Black says, the Jews of America could lead public opinion and marshal government action. They had this power and they used it continuously. Wielding this power inspired the conspiracy theories, and so Jewish leaders were often reluctant, But what choices did they have? After its expulsion from Israel in the 2nd century, Judaism became a religion without a state and thus without an army. Page 36. Chapter: The Lonely Decision, Approaching Day One. But then Blumenfeld stepped forward on behalf of the Zionists, declaring that the German Zionist Federation was uniquely capable of conferring with Jewish leaders in other countries, since German Zionists were affiliated with a worldwide organization. Once uttered, the words forever changed the relationship between the Nazis and the Zionists. It was suddenly clear that the Jewish group the Reich had been ignoring was, in fact, the one it should be negotiating with in its efforts to combat the Jewish presence in Germany. After all, both Nazis and Zionists agreed that Jews did not belong in Germany. This in itself is a horrific statement to see published in a book by Macmillan by a young Jewish author, page 36. Because in essence, it encapsulates the Nazi policy towards the Jews and the Zionist response to it. The German Nazi government did not want to have Jews in Germany and in Europe, and the Zionists wanted the Jews out of Europe. And so it was quite natural that these two forces should ally themselves. It was an alliance of convenience. Many people have been confused about this Nazi-Zionist connection and have wondered why, for instance, Rabbi Stephen Weiss in the United States was such a vociferous opponent of Adolf Hitler organizing these boycotts. And I think that on page 68, approaching day one, in this book, The Transfer Agreement, there is partially an answer. It says, on April 1st, Völkischer Beobachter printed a photograph of the enemy of Adolf Hitler. It was a picture of Stephen S. Weiss standing beside two Congress supporters. Late the night before, Goebbels wrote privately that the struggle against international Jewry will be a fight to the finish. Quote, April 1st was therefore day one. The Nazis has launched their war against the Jews, mobilizing all of Germany. The Jews would launch their war against the Nazis, mobilizing all the world. Anti-Hitler boycotts, protest marches, and meetings were now in store. Germany was to be isolated politically, economically, even culturally, until she cast off her Nazi leadership. Germany was to be taught another bitter lesson. That's on page 68 of the transfer agreement. Now, it means that in order to get the Jews out of Germany, Rabbi Stephen Weiss had to use this leverage. And of course, there was this confluence of policy. Hitler wanted the Jews out of Germany. And of course, Rabbi Stephen Weiss, by making this international boycott, kind of angered the Germans to the point where the Germans also reacted angrily and put the fear of God into German Jews. And so this is how this terrible spiral took place. This is part one of our series looking into Nazi-Zionist collaboration and Nazi-Zionist relations, as chronicled in the book The Transfer Agreement by the Jewish writer Edwin Black. I'm Ernst Sundel. You can reach me at 206 Carlton Street in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, postal code M5A2L1. Our telephone number 416-922-9850. We will continue this topic in another broadcast. Auf Wiedersehen.